Okay, today is the fifth and final interview with Rogers Hollingsworth. As usual, we are here in his house in Madison. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Rogers, to help me with the sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, Hollingsworth, Hollingsworth.
Perfect. All right, so we're recording just fine, and as usual, we talked a little bit before we turned on the recorder, and there's some research, you sort of pre-emeritus research you'd like to talk about, so let's start there.
First of all, one thing I would like to say with great emphasis, the great indebtedness which I have to my wife throughout my career, her name is Ellen Jane Hollingsworth. She and I have edited and or authored several books and written a good many academic papers. Moreover, I sometimes think that Ellen Jane has read every single word before it has been published, and she has been indispensable to me in my career. Second, she's had her own career. She at one time was the research director of the Mental Health Research Center here at the University of Wisconsin, and for many years she was a member of the Institute for Poverty at the university. So she has worked in a number of different areas over the years, but at any rate, I want to emphasize my indebtedness to her. Now, we've been talking a bit about my research in the medical area, and I would like to say that last time I was talking a bit about this, but I would like to say that before I get to the main research topic I want to focus on is that I did publish some years ago a book entitled The Political Economy of Medicine, Great Britain and the United States. This was an effort to explain why these two countries emerged with two very different medical sense systems, and with what consequences. Increasingly, I have been interested in how things are organized and what consequences flow from that. The next book that I wrote, and which is one of the more important books I think I've written in my career, is entitled State Intervention in Medical Care. This I wrote with two colleagues, one a gentleman by the name of Gerald Haig. Jerry was professor of sociology here, later moved to be chairman of the sociology department at the University of Maryland, and Robert Hanneman, whom I call Bob. And Bob was a graduate student working with Jerry and with me. And I later wrote a book with Bob, and Bob and I have written a number of, well, I should say, several academic papers in our careers. Bob is professor at the University of California, Riverside, and is a wonderful citizen and a very creative scholar. This book is very complex, and it is indicative of how I think as problems become increasingly complex, it becomes difficult for a single scholar to address the problems. And so in this project, more than one scholar was necessary. I started this project, and originally it was to be about medical care and education in four countries, Britain, France, Sweden, and the United States, 1890 to 1970. There were two other colleagues originally in this project, Oa Sorensen, that's A-A-G-E, Sorensen, and Robert Alford, A-L-F-O-R-D. Oa was chairman of the sociology department here at Madison, a rather distinguished department, and Bob was also a professor in the sociology department. So as I said, I initiated this project. Oa is from Denmark and was to assume the responsibility for working on education and health in Sweden. Bob was going to work with me on the American system. Jerry was going to work on France, and Bob to a considerable extent on Britain. Now, along the way, Oa leaves Wisconsin and becomes chairman of the sociology department at Harvard, and Bob leaves to go to the University of California, Santa Cruz. And Jerry eventually leaves to go to the University of Maryland. I don't think I was responsible for their leaving. But anyway, I was left behind, and we have these two huge projects. So eventually, what happened was the education part of these projects got dropped. And Bob and I would later write a book on education, the development of the education systems in Britain and the United States during the 20th century. And I ended up doing essentially the work on Sweden, Britain, and the U.S., and Jerry Haig, primarily on France. And Bob was extraordinarily well-trained and skilled in statistical analysis. And there is a great deal of statistical analysis in this project. What were we concerned with was how the structure of the medical systems of Britain, France, the U.S., and Sweden had consequences for their performance. And we looked at performance in a variety of ways. One, their impact on mortality or levels of health, how it impacted on inequality, that is inequality to access for care, as well as inequality in levels of health measured primarily by age, sex, standardized mortality rates, on their efficiency, and finally on innovations. Now, the innovation part proves to be very important. This book was awarded the prize by the International Political Science Association for the best book in comparative public policy in the year it was published, and I was quite proud of that book because this is one of the more difficult projects to do. Just to give you one example, on the mortality rates in Sweden, which is somewhat typical of what was going on elsewhere, we did age, sex, standardized mortality rates, and the data published by the various census bureaus would publish mortality rates in 1 year, perhaps zero mortality rates at 0 to 1 years of age, and then 1 to 4. And then somewhat later, the same country would publish the census rates for birth to age 4. And then another country would do it differently. So it was necessary for me to go to Stockholm and work in the archives and actually recompute these mortality rates so we could standardize them across countries and over time. I have a couple of tables in this book that literally took 4 or 5 years to construct. That was not the only thing I was doing at the time, but this was quite a difficult undertaking. Now, but this book, focusing on innovations, increased my interest in innovations. I'd already published several papers on innovations. And in my work, I attempted to look at innovations in terms of incremental innovations that seem to have only a modest impact on the societies in which they occurred, and what I call radical innovations. And radical innovations are those, as indicated, are those that have a fundamental impact on societies. I had become increasingly interested in the subject. Why do research organizations, that is universities, research institutes and the like, vary in their ability to make major breakthroughs in basic biomedical science. Now, much of my previous work had been in the area of clinical science. I decided to do this project because I knew a great deal about medical care and medical systems. This project is a four-nation project also, but it includes Germany. It does not include Sweden. So this project was about why research organizations vary in making major breakthroughs in these four countries, Britain, France, Germany, and the United States, from 1900 to the year 2000, and later we extended this to bring it down to the present. Now this project, if I thought the other one was complicated, this one became extraordinarily complicated. So, first of all, what was a major discovery? And this troubled me for a great deal because I wanted to define a major discovery in such a way that the scientific community would agree with me on what a major discovery was, and that they would read this work and study it. And indeed, I've been enormously surprised by the reception this work has had in the scientific community. I have ended up being invited to lecture to medical schools and to be members of scientific departments and the like, and I'll come to that in a few minutes. So how did I finally come up with what is a major discovery in basic, and remember, is basic biomedical science? A number of different indicators. First of all, Nobel Prize in medicine. Second, a Nobel Prize in chemistry, but only insofar as that prize had an impact on basic biomedical science. The Lasker Prize, probably the second most prestigious award in basic biomedical science, and so that was third one. There was the Copley Medal. Copley Medal is awarded for several fields, including one is mathematics, the other in basic biomedical science. So I chose to focus on the Copley medals only for those that were awarded for research in the basic biomedical sciences. The Copley Medal is awarded by the Royal Society, which is the most distinguished scientific organization in Great Britain. And so we use the Copley Medal. Let me say that when I say we, my wife, Ellen Jane, has been working with me on this project. This is the project about which I spoke about the funding from the National Science Foundation in the last interview. I did have my colleague Jerry Haig working on this project. Again, Jerry is knowledgeable about France, and so Jerry was proved to be quite a disappointment to me. I view Jerry as one of my mentors early on. He and I did some teaching together here at Wisconsin, and I learned a great deal from Jerry. And Jerry has a great expertise on innovations. And so Jerry was instrumental in our getting this project off the ground. Jerry was funded more than any of us to do the research on France and half the research on Germany. Unfortunately, along the way, Jerry reported to me that he had lost all of his data that he had collected on France. And second, unfortunately, for reasons I never understood, Jerry did no research on Germany. So the work, to a considerable extent, fell on me and Ellen Jane. I did have a younger colleague, Ragnar Bjork, a Swedish scholar, who did assist a good bit in our working in the archives in Stockholm in the Royal Swedish Academy of Science and the Karolinska Institute. Now, then there are other indicators of what is a major discovery. After the Copley Medal, as I indicated, we did have access to a number of the archives of the Karolinska Institute, which awards the prizes in physiology or medicine, and also the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which awards the chemistry prizes. So we had the access to these archives only down to a certain point in time, and so we had a criteria that we would choose those nominations for prizes which had received a certain number of nominations that would vary slightly over time. And so we included those as major discoveries if they met our threshold, realizing, of course, that not every deserving bit of work results in a Nobel Prize. Then, aside from the nominations, these two organizations have what is called prize-worthy. And those are recognitions that maybe a certain body of work did not meet the threshold, but the committees awarding the prizes and having studied these, and I must say the Swedes deserve a great deal of credit because they really take this activity very responsibly. So if they decided that something was prize-worthy, and they would study it with great intensity, even though that body of work might not have resulted in a Nobel Prize, we included that in our population of major discoveries. And finally, there was the Louisa Gross Horowitz Prize in Basic Biomedical Science. Now, these various indicators seem to satisfy the scientific community. I have never received any criticism by anyone in the scientific community, except that one or two scholars have suggested, well, we might have used minor prizes. Well, we did I and some students here in Wisconsin and did another small project just to try to find out if it would have made any difference in the organizations where major discoveries occurred, and this more modest research indicated that it would not. So where did we go from here? So the idea is, well, where did these major discoveries occur? And here, in some respects, that was not so difficult, but in other respects, it was extraordinarily difficult because some individuals would receive a prize, but if the individual had worked in only one organization throughout his or her career, we could easily determine where the research occurred. But a number of individuals moved in their careers, and so then the question was, well, where did the work really occur? And so this required a great deal of archival work, this time not in the Swedish archives, but in the archives of many scientists and many research organizations. And that proved very difficult. And so ultimately, we were able to determine to our satisfaction where this work occurred. Now, sometimes it was very difficult. And I'm sure in our body of work, we've made some mistakes. I'll give you two examples of where early on we had made mistakes. One Nobel laureate, who actually received the Nobel Prize for work done here in Wisconsin, was Joshua Lederberg. The question was, well, where did Lederberg do his work? Lederberg had also been at Yale University, and he did some of that work at Yale. I was able to find that out simply by working with Lederberg's papers and the like. But some years later, I met Lederberg and got to know him moderately well. And Josh told me, well, you know, I really started that body of work when I was an undergraduate at Columbia University. I talked to him at some length, and indeed I became convinced that that work really did begin at Columbia. So then in my research, Columbia gets some credit. It was a zero-sum game. You even got credit or you didn't. Columbia receives credit for that prize. Yale receives credit, and the University of Wisconsin. Another Nobel recipient was a gentleman by the name of Conrad Bloch. I had coded originally Bloch's work from my research on him, and rather extensive research as having occurred at the University of Chicago, where he'd spent much of his career, and at Harvard University. Finally, I was able to spend some time with Bloch at Harvard, and we talked, and Bloch said, oh, I began that work when I was a graduate student at Columbia University, and we had a rather extensive conversation about that. So here, we ended up coding Conrad Bloch's work as occurring at Columbia, Chicago, and Harvard. Now, when I say there may be mistakes, there are some, of course, who are... I've conducted over interviews with over 600 scientists, and a number of many more times than that, so altogether probably over 1,000 interviews. Obviously, I did not interview a number of scientists, and a number of them, of course, were dead. So I suspect along the way there have been some mistakes. As we go back farther and farther in time toward the 19th century, I mean, the beginning of the 20th century, of course, there was not as much mobility in the careers of scientists. So I am somewhat doubtful that we made a lot of errors, but anything is possible.
Rogers, can I jump in for a second? Unless you're going to address this at some point, I wonder if you could answer the question why you chose to do interviews as part of your research.
Well, I'm studying research organizations. And so one of the things is, and this is very critical, and thank you for raising this, because one of the things is not just did it occur at Harvard or did it occur at the University of Kansas and the what, but then a major component of this is what are the characteristics of the organizations. If you'll recall, I have become increasingly a student of organizations. So what is there about the structure of the organization that facilitates this kind of major breakthrough? And so this required working and studying the research organizations and working in many, many archives. Indeed, I might thank you for raising this. The Rockefeller Archive Center in Tarrytown, New York, is just an unbelievable source for this kind of research. The Rockefeller Archive, before the Second World War, had an office in Paris, and they had several quite brilliant scientists who worked there, and they would go across several countries in Europe visiting laboratories in various universities. And it's just a great source of information of how the labs were structured, what the universities were like. And so I'm really trying to understand the structure of organizations and indeed even the labs. Now this becomes an incredibly complex research project. And then another thing we wanted to do is that we knew that, again, all distinguished organizations that did not, all places that received Nobel Prize or did not receive Nobel Prizes were quite outstanding. But what was there about organizations that we had good reason to believe were quite distinguished but did not receive Nobel Prizes? So how do we address that problem? Well, one of the major awards in science in the United States is the National Academy of Sciences. And that's an indicator that a scientist and or his or her lab is doing outstanding work in Great Britain. It was whether one was a member of the Royal Society. And so if we found universities that had some members of the Royal Society or some members of the National Academy, but never received a major credit for a major discovery, we wanted to know that. So we would zero in on those organizations as a kind of control, making the project much more complicated. And so it was these interviews that helped us to understand the structural labs, to understand the structure of these organizations, and we later were able to place in various boxes the various institutions and various labs. Sometimes, of course, what would happen in some of our organizations, and most often you would have a lab that was quite distinguished, but at the same institution, and in a major discovery would occur, but in the same institution, sometimes you would have a lab structured similarly, but no major discovery would occur. Now, along the way, Ellen Jane and I, and Jerry, his name was on it, we finished a manuscript, this voluminous study, and sent it off to Cambridge University Press for publication. Now, Cambridge is a very excellent publishing house, and it usually takes about a year or a little more to go through a pretty rigorous peer review. And the reports came back on that, which were unanimous with great praise. By then, however, I decided the book didn't meet my standards. And so I withdrew it from publication. What was wrong with it? Well, we had been studying labs and we had been studying organizations, but I had now realized that some labs were similar to other labs in the same organization. But what was different then about those labs? And I became very frustrated that there were, of course, individual characteristics. Now, this really threw a big monkey wrench in my research, as far as I was concerned. Remember, I'm suggesting this manuscript got excellent praise from the our reviewers. But now I realize, well, gee, this is a serious problem. I don't have sufficient information on the individuals. So then that, I withdrew that, and I have been working on that part of the project for some years, though along the way, don't misunderstand me, I have published a number of papers on the organizations and on the labs, and in part, I think I became somewhat famous for this. I began to be invited to give lectures in various science departments, to be in residence in some of the countries, or even Europe's most distinguished labs, and like it was very, it's been very stimulating and gratifying to get that kind of praise. So then I began to start working on creativity in science, and that permitted me now to begin working on individuals. And there's a voluminous literature on creativity. So now I began to tackle that problem. And how do we define individuals who have high creativity in science? I find it very interesting that I have yet to receive much criticism in terms of what I've done here. Of course, this interview may well invite a great deal of criticism, but this has been extraordinarily exciting for me. And so I came up with the concept high cognitive complexity. High cognitive complexity. And I began to note, as I began to have a large population of scientists who were highly creative. Many of them, of course, were those who made major discoveries, and a number of them were scientists who were recognized as highly creative but had not received one of these 10 criteria, but had received a number of others. And as I began, I developed a large data file on about 300 scientists. This comes back in part to your question of why am I doing all these interviews? Because I'm now beginning to work much more at the level of the individual. And so I have this concept, high cognitive complexity. And many of these people internalize what I call multiple cultures. And it's very interesting that in the early part of the 20th century, especially in Germany and in Austria, and that a very significant number of Jews made major discoveries. Now, we know from a great deal of literature that Jews have been quite creative, but what was there about being Jewish? Was it the religious background? Well, what I began to learn as I studied more and more biographies, interviewed some of these people, that many of these people were individuals who did not have a strong sense of identity. They thought of themselves as being Jewish, but also as being German. They were living in more than one culture at a time. And by living in these dual cultures, they were able to see things in more complex ways than those who did not share or internalize these multiple cultures. It's rather interesting that many of these individuals, when they would go to the university, they were often outsiders. They would work in multiple fields. So one of the, when you go back and look at these major discoveries that I have identified, every single one, without exception, have been quite interdisciplinary in nature. And it seems to me it's impossible to create or do a major discovery if you're not an individual crossing different fields. And as I began to explore this, many of these people really did, as I've interviewed them, many of them, as I've studied their biographies, read their work and or studied them in archives, a very significant percentage of these people internalize multiple cultures. Just to give you a few examples, at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, there were a couple of people. There was Jacques Monod, one of the great scientists after the Second World War at the Institut Pasteur. Now, Monod had grown up in the south of France, and France is primarily a Catholic country. But he grew up in Huguenot, in the kind of Huguenots, part of France. His parents were Protestants. His mother was from Milwaukee. His father was a painter, but was interested in science. So Monod grew up in this kind of multicultural environment. I can, of course, give you many more such cases.
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
Just for a second? I want to confirm something. So you said that these folks primarily were outsiders at the university. Were they outsiders in their own department? Because later
these
you
people,
say that they're interdisciplinary.
These people, in my opinion, generally had no strong personal identity. So these were people, I think, who had a concept as being outsiders. Now, this concept, in I'm thinking, is not unique with me. A German sociologist at the turn of the 20th century by the name of Simmel, S-I-M-M-E-L, wrote something of a theoretical nature. And then another sociologist in the 1920s at the University of Chicago by the name of Park also began to play with the concept of outsider. So I don't know when I became aware of their work. I think it was probably after I had this concept and began to try to challenge myself. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I'm not unique in developing this concept. But these people view themselves pretty much as outsiders in their society, in their universities, and everywhere. Now, let me give you an example of how this sort of, this changed my life. One of the really creative scientists in this country over, the last 70 years or so, is a gentleman by the name of Gerald Edelman, G-E-R-A-L-D, Edelman. Now, Edelman was a scientist at Rockefeller University, and I was in, there is a German scientist by the name of Manfred Eigen, E-I-G-E-N. And Eigen was received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, German. And for his work, he had several patents and became very wealthy. Eigen used a bit of his wealth to hold winter seminars in Klosters, Switzerland, a beautiful spot, just a couple of kilometers from Davos, which most of you know of from the press. And so he would hold these winter seminars and invite people from a variety of fields to talk about their work. They may have been in musicologists, but the overwhelming majority of them were essentially in science. I was invited by Eigen to go. I was not a speaker, but it was quite stimulating to go. And there was this scientist from Rockefeller University who had already received a Nobel Prize, Gerald Edelman, who had left Rockefeller and had become director of the Neuroscience Institute in La Jolla, California. I asked Edelman if I might interview him, and so he and I met, and we talked for about an hour and a half, and I talked to him a great deal about his career, about Rockefeller University, which by then I had done a great deal of research. And toward the end of the hour, I said to Edelman, who is Jewish, I said, I wonder if you would mind if I try some ideas out on you concerning my views of creativity. And I rolled out my views of high cognitive complexity, how Jews, I thought, were able to see things in more complex terms and the like. And so we chatted a bit for about 30 minutes about that. And then he said, I'll tell you what, I would like for you to come and spend some time at the Neuroscience Institute. Why don't you plan to come for 3 months? We have some nice apartments. They have swimming pool and tennis courts. We'll give you an office, a part-time secretary, an automobile, and we'll pay you for your expenses. Well, La Jolla is a beautiful location, and so I can tell you I didn't turn that invitation down. And I, for the next 3 years, was invited, and I mean for the next 2 years, was invited there. And meantime, my daughter lives in Los Angeles, and as I was already working on Caltech and UCLA and the University of California, San Diego, my wife and I decided, well, we would spend more time in La Jolla. Now, in the meantime, for 8 or 9 years, I became a visiting fellow, could go to this institute anytime I wanted, and Jerry Edelman and I became very close friends, and I think it's fair to say that his wife and my wife are, they are the closest of friends. Now, Edelman is an extraordinarily competitive man. He's not easy to get along with, but I'm not a scientist, and I don't compete. I didn't compete with Edelman. Jerry Edelman, in my opinion, had enormous intellectual diversity. He knew more about poetry than anyone I've ever met. He knew an incredible amount about philosophy. Like Minot, he had been early on an accomplished violinist. Jerry actually wanted to be a professional violinist. Being as competitive as he is, he realized that he was not going to rival Itzhak Perlman as a concert violin player, so he decided he would go into science. Jerry's Nobel Prize was essentially for a paper, or the committee cited a paper that he wrote as a graduate student, though if that's all he'd ever written in the subject, he would not have undoubtedly received the prize, but he had carved out this area. Edelman was quite a brilliant man, and maybe the most brilliant person I've ever met. And Jerry opened all kinds of doors for me into American and British science, and I owed a great deal of to him. Now, let me come back to these major discoveries and where they occurred. For some years, as I would lecture to audiences about my research, I would say to the audiences, now given these 10 criteria I have for defining a major discovery, if anyone in the audience can tell me which organization in the world had more major discoveries, as I've defined them, in the 20th century than any other, I will host you to any restaurant in the world of your choice. I never lost that bet. After a while, I'd published so much on this research, I stopped making that bet. But the answer tells you a great deal about the findings of my research. The answer is Rockefeller University on the Upper East Side of Manhattan at around 63rd Street. Rockefeller University today has only 70 professors. It's a very small organization. It has had 10 presidents slash directors. They changed the title of the head of the organization in 1953. Of those 10, six of them were Nobel laureates at the time they were appointed. Two of them were presidents of the National Academy of Sciences when they were appointed. Another had received the Louisa Gross Horowitz Prize. And so these people were quite distinguished scientists. They knew what was going on in science. Now let me jump across half the continent, and we look at the University of Wisconsin, where I spent almost all my professional career. And it is, I think, one of the reasons I perhaps got into this research, or certainly one of the reasons I began to see certain patterns, is because of my career here in Wisconsin. Certainly at the opposite, very opposite in the continuum from Rockefeller. The University of Wisconsin, in my judgment, is probably the most complex university in the world. First of all, we have the University of Wisconsin system, but of course that came about rather late, sometime in the 1970s. But on the Madison campus, we have a chancellor, we have several, in fact, a number of vice chancellors, we have a provost whose responsibility is primarily with the faculty. Then we have a number of vice provosts and one or two assistant provosts. Then we have 9 separate colleges, a College of Medicine, Law, Veterinary Medicine, College of Letters and Sciences, and so forth. Each college has a dean. There are associate deans. Letters and Sciences, for example, has 5 or 6 associate deans. Then there are a battery of assistant deans. Then we are at the departmental level. Here in the Letters of Sciences at Madison, in chemistry, the chemistry department has approximately 90 faculty members. And then there are associate chairs. There are assistant chair of the department. And so it's very complex. And one of the things that has been happening in the world of science, and this is global, not just here at Wisconsin or anywhere in particular, there are so many papers being written that no one can really read more than a very small amount of the literature in one's own field. And so when it comes to in making appointments or making promotions, faculty in many universities simply do not read the work of their colleagues. Second, they can't even understand it. And the idea, unlike Rockefeller, that the head of the institution, the chancellor, who also is responsible for intercollegiate athletics and the like, and dealing with the NCAA and the like, In my judgment, our very large research organization is somewhat out of control. The people at the top level don't have the capacity to understand the work of, they certainly don't read the work of people being appointed and the like, in most cases. Deans don't, and so forth and so on. So I sometimes worry very much that our universities are out of control. Now, the Rockefeller is very much an exception. Last October, I was fortunate to spend about 2.5 hours with the president of Rockefeller University, and it is extraordinarily careful in appointing a outside faculty. And he told me that the previous year they had about 320 candidates for a position, but they made no appointment. But almost all their faculty were involved in the evaluation process. When candidates come in for job interviews, it is expected that most of the faculty will be involved. And so I think that is one of the reasons why it has been very successful. But then the other, so there are two variables that I, having done all this research, place great emphasis on. And those variables are communication and integration. One is the ability of a faculty to communicate with others in the organization and continue learning from each other. The other variable is integration, the extent to which they are integrated with one another. For many years, for example, at the Rockefeller, certainly during the first 50 years of its existence, it was founded in 1901, there was a lunchroom, and no old tables existed, had no more than 6 chairs. It was possible to carry on a single conversation. And it's quite remarkable that a number of scientific fields actually occurred over the lunch table at Rockefeller. The field of modern cell biology emerged at Rockefeller with 3 scientists receiving Nobel Prizes. A major aspect of modern neuroscience developed at the Rockefeller. So there is this in enormous amount of communication among scientists in different fields, and the place is highly integrated. And I mention these two organizations not because I wish to run down the University of Wisconsin, but in terms of ideal types. So it becomes, now Wisconsin, I must say, has had several major breakthroughs over time. I mentioned Joshua Lederberg earlier on. There's Oliver Smitty's, who left here and is now at the University of North Carolina. There was Howard Timmon, who spent almost his entire career here. And there was Gobain Khorana, who left after making his major discovery here and went to MIT. And so let me mention Khorana again very briefly. So Khorana grew up in a village in India. His father was an Indian civil servant. It was a small village, and Karana's family was the only one that could speak English. So here Khorana grew up in this environment where he internalized a great deal of multiple cultures. And I think that did a great deal to help his ability to see the world in more complex terms. He later would go to Great Britain for his PhD, and he went to Switzerland, the German part of Switzerland, at ETH, to do a postdoc. And then he ends up going to British Columbia for a good bit of his research, and then he was recruited here at Madison. And so he, I credit the two organizations, British Columbia and Canada, and here at Madison, where he did his his major work. But here is another case of individuals who did their who internalized what I call high cognitive complexity. I did interview Howard Temin on several occasions, got to know him moderately well. I did get to know Joshua Lederberg a great deal, and then there's Karana, whom I interviewed only once. But at least I think this confirmed, at least for Wisconsin, these individuals. Another thing, coming back to integration and communication, our research institutes. I became very interested along the way in, since it's in a huge university, how can you structure it in such a way that you can have this kind of rich interaction and the like? And my research has indicated that you can do it if you have a small research institute within a large university. But all universities have research institutes. The trick is, in the institute, each faculty member must not be in a department simultaneously. Most of these universities are highly disciplinary oriented. So we have a number of institutes here in the Madison campus, and they do very good work. But the individuals are in a disciplinary department, and it is in the department where their salaries have set, where the rewards come, where they're going to have a special professorship or something. But it's in these institutes. Howard Temin was in the McArdle Cancer Research Institute. Karana was in the Institute for Enzyme Research. Their only appointment was in these two institutes. That's where their salaries were set and so forth. So I've done a good bit of research on the issue of institutes. Well, I talk about this to give you some sense of this project. It's been very gratifying to me with the attention and reception that this project has received. And as a result, I have been invited to spend a good bit of my life in major institutes of natural sciences. And I would say that in the last 10 years, I have spent about 80 to 85% of my time interacting with natural sciences scientists. And they have been interested in my research and vice versa. Now, let me come back to creativity. Not only did these scientists internalize a great deal of scientific diversity, but many of these scientists also had avocations in other fields. And so I began to study, as I indicated, I have a large population now of individual scientists. And it's really quite remarkable the number of, well, I have, of course, this population of people, scientists who were Jewish, but then we learned that a large number of them were accomplished physicians, some composers of music. We had painters, and sculptors, woodworkers, scientists who wrote philosophy, history, anthropology, and some who were political activists. Linus Pauling, for example, would receive a Nobel Prize for peace. And so these people, again, this is part of seeing the world in with greater complexity. And I think that is quite important and is so I then began to move down to this level of the individual and understanding. Mm-hmm.
What book are you what book are you referencing there?
This book I'm looking at is a book of lectures that I gave with my wife at the in Vienna a couple of years ago, and the title is Major Discoveries, Creativity, and the Dynamics of Science. And to a considerable extent, it focuses on this kind of research that I've been discussing. Mm-hmm.
I have a question, but I also want, we have about 20 minutes. How much, so I want to alert you to that, but then I also want to ask a question and see where it goes. So in the two books you referenced off the bat, Political Economy and Medicine and State Intervention, you're comparing U.S., Great Britain, and then U.S., Great Britain, Sweden, and France. And then your other research is U.S., Great Britain, Germany, and France.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are over, it's U.S., Great Britain, and France come up quite a bit. U.S. and Great Britain come up on all of those. You know, you have a history where you expressed early interest in Asiatic countries. You lived in Nigeria. My question is why is it these countries and not, say, Russia or India or another European country?
Right. Good question. Why do I do comparative history? First of all, to get variation on the variables I'm interested in. And so one does have to be somewhat selective in the cases that one chooses. I am a historian, though many of my colleagues may not recognize me as a historian. Historians, as I indicated, focus primarily on space and time. But I can't do everything. And so I have a limited number of cases. And I don't really know enough about Britain, France, Germany, perhaps, and the U.S. So I have to limit myself. And so I chose these four countries because they did have a good bit of variation on things that I thought were important. And second, because just from wide reading, I could see that not a large number of these major discoveries in the basic biomedical sciences emerged from Russia. So these are the major countries where they occurred. And then there is variation on these. Now, it is true that along the way, a number of scholars in other fields became interested in my research. The Japanese government, for example, invited me a few years ago to come and be a kind of consultant and study some of their research organizations. The scientific culture in Japan is totally different from anything we see in these four countries. And it's very, so they want to know how they might perform better on some of these variables than they do. Russia has a history of being quite creative in physics and in mathematics, but, and to a lesser extent in chemistry and in physics, but not in my field. So I try to choose my countries with some care, but recognizing limitations of my own knowledge.
Okay, thank you. So I know you still have notes there on your paper, so where would you like to go from here?
One final area that has emerged from all of this, and some of this I wrote in one of the two leading scientific publications in the world, in Nature, and then further elaboration of this subject in this volume I just mentioned, Major Discoveries, Creativity and the Dynamics of Science, is what I call scientific hegemons. And if we look back historically over the last couple of hundred years, what we see is that from time to time, there are scientific hegemons that certain countries exert more influence than any other in science. First of all, there was France, for example, in the late 18th century. And most of the academic and scientific journals were published in French. Scientists from other countries would often go to France to study. And France was a country where there was a great deal of scientific creativity. Next, the leadership passed to Germany. And in Germany in the late 19th and in the 20th century down to about 1930, again, this is a country where there is enormous creativity in the basic biological sciences in chemistry and the like, and then the leadership begins to pass to Great Britain and finally to the U.S. Now, one of the things that catches my attention is, why do these countries become hegemons? And it's my argument that a scientific hegemon requires being to be in the context of a society that becomes very powerful economically, politically, and diplomatically. And that is, these things seem to go together, but without the great economic strength and base, to some extent politically, no scientific hegemon. So following the Napoleonic Wars, we see a real decline of science in the relative influence of science in France. And then the influence passes to Germany. And we see that an emergence of the really first, what we might call modern universities in Germany in the latter part of the 19th century. And German becomes the dominant language of science. And thousands of young Americans flock to Germany in the late and early 19th century. And so Germany became the dominant center of science. And if we look at these major discoveries that I have, and I look at the research organizations, it's very clear that many of these are occurring in Germany. And then there is the Nazi era, and there is a real collapse of the scientific institutions, and I'm sure most of you know a good bit about the story of what happens to German universities in this period. And in the meantime, Great Britain had become a world power. And now, Great Britain did not have as many important centers of science as Germany, but the center of science was very much focused at Cambridge. And Cambridge had a long tradition in science, going back to Isaac Newton. And there, the focus was essentially in their colleges, and the greatest scientific center of science has essentially been Trinity College at Cambridge. Might point out that it's also a center of enormous wealth and is reputed to have more wealth than any institution in Great Britain, with the exception of the royal household. Trinity owns shipping lines, great amounts of wealth in the largest cities, and great investments elsewhere. Now, when I was doing my research and conducting interviews in Great Britain, I went to interview Andrew Huxley. Andrew Huxley was the grandson of T.H. Huxley, who helped to promote Charles Darwin's work. Huxley received the Nobel Prize in the early 1960s, along with Alan Hodgkin, and Hodgkin was deceased by now. Huxley was one of the most distinguished scientists in the world when I interviewed him, and he was a Nobel laureate. He had been former president of the Royal Society. He was master of Trinity College. Trinity is the only Oxford College appointed by the Crown, and a man of great eminence. Again, it's sort of like Jerry Edelman's interview. After about an hour of discussing matters with Huxley, he invited me to come and spend some time at Trinity College. And this was one of the really most stimulating adventures of my life, because Huxley really opened every door there was in British science for me, and it became possible for me to gain access to almost any British scientist I wanted, and to various institutions and the like. But then, after the Second World War, British science, don't misunderstand me, it's still a very strong society scientifically, but clearly the strength had passed to America. And in this country, also, it has been an economic, political, and diplomatic hegemon. And so one of the things that I have raised in the two publications and this on this subject, is in the Nature paper and in this volume, is are the Americans following in the footsteps of these predecessors? Because one thing else, forgive me, I left out. One of the reasons for the decline of these other hegemons was they became overextended in foreign adventures. We see that in the Napoleonic period. We certainly see it in the 1930s and 40s with Germany, and to a very considerable extent with Great Britain. And so as the Americans began to engage in what I call overextension in foreign adventures, which amount up to trillions of dollars, I do think that the Americans would be wise to focus on the consequences of this for its society, and in this case, science. One of the things I might also say in these three other systems, France, Britain, and Germany, is very interesting that the scientific elite, and indeed most scientists, had no idea that their system was beginning to be in decline at the time that it was, that we can now see retrospectively. They were not aware of really the problems. And one of my concerns is that we have these universities that are becoming more and more complex, becoming larger, more bureaucratic, are primarily engaged in trying to raise money. These are things that give me pause, and I think we should be a bit more historically minded as we reflect on what some of the foreign adventures of this country, the cost might be for the future of our societies.
I think it might be a good time to talk about legacy and maybe end there.
Yes, you told me you were going to mention this, and I reflected a bit about it. And people frequently talk about the legacy of individuals, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama. But it's interesting that people are often having others talk about their legacy. I'm not sure that I am competent to talk about my legacy. Maybe I will be forgotten, which most scholars are over time. But I can tell you what I think I would like to be remembered for. And this is something I'm still engaged in, despite the fact that I'm getting older every day. I still think that some of my major ideas are there that I'm still working on. And when I look back on my career, one of the things that catches my attention is that I have become, coming back to these two variables, I'm very interested in communication across fields. And I think this comes from a kind of curiosity I have that originated in the world of Alabama, is to learn more about the world out there. And so as I look back on my career, I find it very interesting that I am spending more and more of my time with people in other fields. And I wrote a paper a few years ago with a colleague of mine in Vienna, Carl Mueller. Carl is another one of these individuals, and it's been my great fortune to get to know. Carl is one of the most brilliant individuals I know. So Carl and I wrote this paper I guess the ideas came from me, since I have been so interested in different disciplines and the like. But the argument of this paper, it's called The Emergence of a New Epistemology. And the argument of this paper is that how disciplines are increasingly wrestling with similar problems, but they're not aware of it. To give you an example, one of the greatest chemists of the 20th century, and certainly in my opinion, the most distinguished scientist that this country produced, was Linus Pauling, a great chemist, a Nobel laureate in chemistry. Pauling received a Nobel Prize for his work in chemical bonds. Now, what on earth does chemical bonds have to do with social science? But it's really quite remarkable how much I have learned from reading Pauling's papers on chemical bonds. Because when we look at these molecules, they are there are bonds in them that are tightly held or loosely held, and they can disintegrate. So when I look at societies, I see that also we see societies, I mentioned in the last discussion, Sweden, which is a society with a great deal of homogeneity, and the people are somewhat tightly bonded together. We look at Yugoslavia, and after the Second World War, it began to disintegrate. And so we have total societies in which they can be tightly or loosely bonded together. I've spoken about Nigeria, a society that I have long thought will eventually disintegrate. Iraq is certainly in my work on state and nation building is another society that I indeed expect to come apart. And so we have a kind of common problem there. Then there is what I call multi-level analysis. And again, if we look across fields, this is another problem that we see a similarity. And so when I am with my colleagues who might be chemists or in other fields, it's indeed interesting that we begin to learn from one another. I may be talking about the social world, they about the natural world, but I think we're learning from each other. Multi-level analysis. Well, many natural scientists are concerned with things at the nanoscale, the atomic level, molecular level, the cellular level. This is in biology. The organ level, the ecosystem, and the like. One of the problems, one of the great problems in many of the sciences is how do we learn to deal with all these different levels simultaneously? In my research that I've been talking about, we have the individual, we have the lab, we have the organization, we have the total science system and the society. And one of the great challenges I have had is to try to understand the interaction among all of these. But also in terms of societies, we have individuals, we have groups and organizations and so forth and so on. And I think it's interesting that last week we had quite an interesting colloquium over at the University of Wisconsin in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, in which we were talking about the context in which things occur. And there was a physicist, there was a biologist, there was a historian, and how physicists try to work in a world with very little context, and their work is extraordinarily abstract. The biologists somewhat more aware of the context. And finally, the historian, the sociologist, what have you, are very much concerned with the total context in which things are occurring. And it's really quite remarkable what an enormous amount of rich conversation took place in this discussion among a physicist, a biologist, and a historian. I must say that in my career in recent years, it's been very gratifying that I am frequently invited to speak to medical schools. I was asked a few years ago, as a result of my paper with Carl Mueller, by one of the country's leading virologists, to jointly author a paper with him. I must say that out of vanity, I guess, I accepted, though I'm no virologist. I think there is this thirst to understand work across different fields. And it's ironical that we are in this world where there is such intense specialization, and at the same time, this kind of thirst to try to have greater integration and communication across fields. And whether this is just wishful thinking or not, I don't know. I have in the last several years been involved in a couple of projects. None has really come to fruition. To try to create an environment where we may have several small institutes, but where the participants will come together each day for lunch. One of the things I do when I go around studying research organizations is to go to the lunchroom. Where do they eat? What kind of communication is going on? And to me, that tells me a lot about the organization. I think you indicated one more thing, Troy, you suggested I might touch on, and that's my retirement. I retired approximately 15 years ago in the year 2000. I felt that my work was going better than it ever had. I'd been more productive, in my opinion, and creative than I'd ever been. I'd been very fortunate to have a great deal of research for my funding. For my research, and but it meant that I was away more and more from the University of Wisconsin, and I felt very guilty that my colleagues here in Madison were serving on committees, working very hard, particularly on promotions and appointments, and then I would come in and be very critical or have a different view. And I didn't think it was quite fair or even ethical for me to come in and have different views and criticize my colleagues. I guess the real motivating factor was that being a university professor with professorial responsibilities is very time consuming. And so over time, I think I became more and more consumed by my research. And so I did decide to retire, even though my income based on retirement was about 60% lower than what it would have been had I continued not to retire. So it has been very costly financially. But on the other hand, I think I've never been more creative. I, in preparing for this, if you looked over today, my vita, and in this 15-year period, I've written 36 papers in very scholarly articles, a number of them with being a joint author. I think I'm probably the exception of one being the first author. We might have talked a little bit about this business of authorship. Three books. I have given 61 public university lectures at various universities and lectured in at least 10 countries. So it's been very rewarding. I felt like I was a free man. I became a free man upon retiring. And I use the word retirement cautiously because I don't feel that I have retired. And I have more plans than I ever had. I think often that each day I'm more ignorant than the previous day. Mm-hmm. And I have more, become more aware mm-hmm. of things I don't know.
Well, Rogers, I think even though you just called yourself ignorant, I think this might not be a bad place to wrap up. So thank you very much for your time and the time that you've given me for all these interviews. I appreciate it.